Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record as part of the Learning College permanently archived at vnnforum.com and probably also one day at alexlinder.com. If you've just newly come across me, us, what we do, and you want to hear more, always try those two. The alexlinder.com or try the audio section at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to conclude The Eradicator by Mike Smith, 2024 novel. We're going to do the last session, which will be chapters 23 and 24, pages 175 to 190, bottom of 175. So let's get right to it. The Eradicator, chapter 23, We Must Secure Our Existence. Chapter 23, We Must Secure Our Existence. At the entrance, Jake stopped. He shook his head. I will only allow scientists to watch the work, he insisted. Noah looked at him, then at the others. After a moment, Noah said, Very well. He addressed the others. All of you will wait out here. You too, Jake told them. But why? Noah asked. I can be very helpful. Because it's a dangerous formula. It could harm everyone in the building if I make a mistake. Noah's eyes glistened with tears. But I want to help. I believe in what you're doing. It's so important to me. Jake thought that Noah might bawl like a baby, so he cut him off with, All right, you can assist, but the others must remain here. We will need them when we come out with the formula. Jake and Noah heard a murmuring sound. They turned and saw that three of the agents had bowed their heads. These agents were praying. His eyes dry now, Noah informed Jake. They're religious. They're blessing you. Jake watched them fervently praying. He shook his head again. Then he turned to Noah and nodded to the entrance. Noah nodded back, and they proceeded into the building. Jake tried not to look at the great damage Chad had done to the walls, the reception desk, the elevator doors. He ignored the bullet holes, and he and Noah took an elevator up. On the third floor, they proceeded toward the labs Jake had been using. Police tape crossed a few hallways, and they had to lift it to go under. In one hallway stood a soldier holding a rifle. Him too, Jake told Noah. Noah signaled the soldier to leave. Everyone out, Noah called after him. No one is to remain in the building. Jake and Noah entered the labs. The neatness there surprised Jake. Everything stood as he had left it. He asked Noah, Didn't they investigate my activities? Nothing is disturbed. We got to them before they could do anything here. Jake felt suspicious of that answer. It didn't seem likely. Nevertheless, everything waited for him, and so he went to work. Noah assisted, but mostly watched. Jake could tell that Noah didn't know what he was watching. Occasionally, he got Noah to bring him a sample. But there was nothing else for Noah to do except stand there. After a few hours, he sat down, but without taking his small black eyes off Jake. All right, now we go and get the bioweapon stuff. That's the sequenced and edited smallpox, Jake said. Why? Where? I'll show you. You see, Jake continued as they walked down the hall to another suite of labs. The bioweaponry program has the best gene splicing equipment. That is interesting, Noah nodded. It is, and we'll do some work there and bring it back to our labs. How long, Mr. McAllister, do you anticipate it will take to complete your work? Not long, Jake answered. The bioweapons people made most of the template we can run our pacification virus on. After another 6 hours of work, Jake heard Noah asking, strangely enough, What will you call it? His voice sounded flat, and his eyes had a sideways look when Jake glanced at him. What do you mean? Jake asked. What will you call this formula? Jake thought about it. Liberation, he answered after a moment. I'll call it Liberation. He was thinking of the title of Greta's hit movie. And why Liberation? Because it will liberate mankind from the curse of great ape strife and destruction. Noah nodded approvingly, and Jake continued working. They couldn't see the sunset and the gathering darkness outside because the labs had no windows, but they knew that it was night when Jake poured a purple liquid into a test tube and said, There. That would be the purple liquid on the cover of the novel. Noah perked up. What do you mean? It's done? That's it? He pointed at the test tube. Not quite, Jake said. It's not effective until we have a large quantity. We need a bunch of it? Noah asked. Jake nodded yes. And how long will that take? A few more hours. We'll batch it in a tank on the fourth floor. Noah seemed to hesitate. He was looking at the purple liquid in the test tube. Finally, reluctantly, he said, okay. You can help me a lot there, Jake said, smiling. Can we go there now? Jake stopped the test tube and stood up. Noah followed him out. Jake and Noah entered a room on the floor above. A vertical black tank almost filled the room. Jake spent some time finding the correct presets and then inserting the inputs. A small hum told him that the tank had come to life. Something inside it was mixing the chemicals like a blade turning batter. Jake made enough to fill 40 test tubes, but in two batches. The second batch wasn't purple. Noah asked him about that. Jake replied that the second batch wasn't purple because it was, quote, the activator. They filled the first 20 test tubes with the purple liquid, the next 20 tubes with the non-purple. All this took half an hour because they had to be careful and move slowly. Then they placed the test tubes on racks and put the racks into two separate boxes. These safety boxes weighed almost 20 pounds each by themselves. Jake gave Noah the box with the non-purple liquid to carry. While they rested for a moment, Jake asked Noah, and now, where do you want them? Where will we take them? To our labs, Noah answered, in Haifa. Never been to Haifa. You'll like it, Noah said in a flat, uninterested voice. They proceeded to the ground floor and exited the building. As soon as they stepped into the street, Jake saw that something was wrong. In the light of the streetlights, the 8 Shin Bet agents were standing side by side with Dr. Hurwitz, fronting them. The agents raised their guns, aiming at Jake and Noah. Noah walked across to Hurwitz. He told Hurwitz, good job, and gave him his safety box. Hurwitz gave it to an agent behind him. Jake didn't move. The gun barrels glistened. Smiling, Hurwitz told Jake, we suspected Kyle Dale for a long time, but we couldn't pin anything on him. Now we know he's an anti-Semite. Jake understood that Dale and Greta would be in trouble. Noah's voice sounded almost as flat as before, but was marginally more hostile now. Give Dr. Hurwitz your half, pig, he told Jake. He'll find out what it is. Jake looked at them all. He said, I thought you were the good Jews. Hurwitz said, there are only Jews. I thought you were the good Jews. Hurwitz said, there are only Jews. Suddenly a shot rang out and Noah fell dead. His brain cavity was blown away. The agents and Hurwitz turned to see the source of the shot. The source was Chad, who was standing atop a building across the street. The agents returned fire, but Chad had ducked behind the parapet. Some agents dispatched themselves to raid the building and take him. As they took off, their boots slapping the pavement, Jake unlatched his safety box and then threw it down with all his strength. He turned away from the flash ignition. When he turned back, he saw through the smoke, caused by the ignition of liberation, that it worked. The agents were falling, clawing at their own throats, even the ones who were now all the way across the street. Hurwitz already lay face down, dead. Liberation and dispersion would invade the rest of Tel Aviv. In its dispersed state, it couldn't cause death right away like this, or even symptoms. Jake reckoned the incubation period to be anywhere from 8 to 14 months. Dozens, then hundreds, then thousands of Jews would spread it worldwide. Chad ran up to him, his leg making the chonk sound. What was that, a smoke grenade? Why aren't we like them? He demanded, pointing at the corpses. Jake told him to shoot them. Sir, they're already dead. Jake didn't repeat the order. He used the edges of his shoes to sweep all the pieces of the test tubes back into the safety box. Chad shot the bodies dutifully and then pulled off the clothes of the two agents. Wearing these clothes, he and Jake got the hell out of there, carrying Shin Bet IDs and roaring off in the Shin Bet personal vehicle. Jake's nerves pulsed with a combination of accomplishment and guilt for being still alive. End of chapter 23. So his formula works. Now Jake and Chad are on the loose. As we head into the final chapter, chapter 24, The Healing of the World, Chad informed Jake that he had dodged an assassination attempt that morning. Shinbet had come to the hotel to terminate him. He anticipated it and was out on the street to see them arrive in the distance. He knew almost instinctively where Jake went. He didn't know why Jake ordered him to leave Israel, though. He guessed that Jake wanted to commit suicide or something. "I had to finish my work," Jake said, and offered no further explanation. Chad joked, "Well, you're brave or foolhardy." Clearly, they couldn't return to the airport. They headed north and reached the moshav of Talmei Elazar. There they purchased clothes and food supplies using their cash of shekels. No one questioned them, though they saw suspicious looks in the eyes of some inhabitants. The two wanted to leave Israel and chose the Syrian border as their next destination. It was about 80 miles away. Scene break. Meanwhile, a mystery roiled Israel. Who shot and killed the Shin Bet agents at the Elie Wiesel Medical Research Center? The assumption was a terrorist did it. But what for? And what terrorists? The nation had experienced no serious terrorism problems since exterminating the Gazans years ago. As months wore on, world health organizations became aware of a new epidemic. People in Israel, Jordan, and southern Iraq were falling ill and dying with concerning rapidity. The cause wasn't determined yet. As the number of fatalities grew, and as the illness reached Saudi Arabia, parts of Italy, and even Shanghai, the organizations pronounced it a pandemic. It spread so fast, and the fatality percentage was so near to 100%, that all Western governments imposed lockdowns on their subjects. No government or health organization publicly mentioned two facts considered too unthinkable to publicize. First, all the victims died fast, within mere hours of falling ill. And second, all the victims had Jewish heritage, quote unquote. Though the authorities found themselves at an embarrassing loss as to the source of the pandemic, some Jews knew, as if by instinct, and soon all Jews sensed it. They sensed what was happening. The immediate result was that Israel unleashed the Samson option. The Samson option, for years a deterrent strategy, proposed to destroy the world in nuclear fire if Israel should die. Now the Holy Land launched the missiles. The first hit at Rome, a second at Tehran, and a third at Paris. The first missile hit its target, the Vatican. The second hit the ruins of Tehran, uselessly, since few lived there longer anyway, and the third vaporized an ape-infested Paris, wiping out almost as many apes as humans. A fourth missile targeted Moscow, but Russia shot it down. The United States wanted to aid its only ally, but no longer had a nuclear strike capacity. Years of replacing human beings with apes at every level of the economy castrated every important aspect of U.S. infrastructure. U.S. authorities didn't let the public know what happened. As censored and compromised as it was already, the internet went dead at last as the authorities shut it down for the common good, quote unquote. Clearly, they expected uprisings and reprisals. The international turn of events had undermined their authority, and they were fearing that shadowy groups of, quote, domestic terrorists or, quote, white supremacists and KKK members might hear news from overseas and take advantage of it. In fact, these groups were so shadowy that they didn't even exist. The first sign of the total and final breakdown of society appeared quickly. The handlers of great apes found themselves dismissed from their positions, often without notice, as when, for example, their pay stopped. They didn't take it well. For years, the government and the culture which it created told them that they were chosen, superior, better and higher than the common run of citizens. Taking seriously this chosen status, many handlers belonged to the Christian identity cult, convinced that they were the true Jews, and just as many were egomaniacs. They formed gangs of uglies who went around murdering all who exercised self-defense against newly unleashed apes. The targets of their malice, which the gangs did not call malice but called a justice crusade, instead, belonged to the younger generations. It was youngsters, not old, half-dead middle-classers, who had the will to fight back against apes and the ability to hide from the gangs. Unguided chaos spread like cancer. In the same way Johnny Clay's space program had died and no rockets reached out for space any longer, so now media, academia, and industry, including the technology industry, were abandoned incrementally at first, then totally, and such things as reliable factories, vehicles, power stations, and hospitals died. No one anywhere could make a nickel for a long time, but Ponzi's and promises had kept what was called the economy going. People used to say, they pretend to pay us, we pretend to work. That was a joke in the old Soviet Union. Now the pretenses were dropped. The population declines alarmed the people who knew of them. Israel was gone. Much of the rest of the Mideast was going. Europe was faltering. What happened to the Jews, most official media would have screamed, had official media existed in force anymore. Throughout the world, but especially in the U.S., Christians started committing suicide in large numbers. Seeing the death of the Jews they knew, they believed that the rapture had come at last, and they didn't make the cut. The chosen did, and were flying up to heaven. So they blew their brains out, leaped from roofs, cut their wrists, and plunged into deep waters, seeking hell and oblivion. The remaining Christians went over to non-Christian cults. Many of these animistic or pagan cults were merely mutual aid societies. Since the Jews invented Christ as a weapon to weaken and sack the Roman Empire and its heirs, the political motive for keeping Christianity together died with the Jews. The churches had no use now, except to host soup kitchens. Read Marcus Eli Ravage for that background on the reality of why Christianity came to exist. Large gangs of motorcyclists, backed by former police and other security types, battled for control of the remnants of political economic centers. They roared into cities and towns on two wheels in groups of 300 or 400 or more, traffic directed by the cops, and took over. But there were fewer people to lord it over, so the motorcyclists began attacking each other, fighting for top spot in the dunghill. Already bad for years, the world's material situation spiraled downward even further. Reparations programs for great apes hadn't helped it. Jews have been collecting, quote, reparations from human beings, allegedly on behalf of apes. Their programs encompassed and impoverished even China, snickeringly called Broken China, by the program's principals. The programs to foster the growth of great ape populations, such as the North American Save the Apes Project, had begun by broadcasting a plea. Help these animals avoid extinction. They ended by flooding the whole world, Europe and the Americas, especially, with great apes. That was the real intent of the programs, which Jews conceived, funded, organized, and ran. Parallel to open borders with Africa, the third world. Jews had found largely Christian cities and towns easy to ape overwhelm by simply arriving with their committees and other Soviets, Soviet means council, brandishing old black and white photographs and issuing to the local chambers of commerce this threat. We are the grandchildren of Holocaust survivors. We don't want to even see even one human face in this town. You must embrace diversity. Then they added, as if speaking to a child, the extinction of humanity is inevitable. It is the wave of the future, and you can't stop it. Jews always portrayed communism as inevitable, as a lot of its power. Near the end of their reign of intimidation, their voices curdling into high-pitched whining, many of them screeched, quote, humans and their oppressive standards of objectivity, honesty, punctuality, hygiene, and logic. We are killing the fucking human race at last. It's the fucking inevitable wave of the fucking future. Fuck you. All those Jews were gone before liberation eradicated them. They had left the cities and towns in ruins, highly moral ruins. Where they went, nobody could tell, but liberation found them. Instead of the end of humanity, it was the end of them. Left were only a few true believers, non-Jew natives soon to die from exhaustion, drink, old age. In a town square, one of them, 52-year-old Alan Brost, educated the wind, standing tall but mumble-droning like an end-stage alcoholic. All are one in the transcendent dimension. Distinctions are material, and the material world isn't real. The transcendent is a place of perfect equality. The transcendent commands us to sacrifice ourselves to other, to any other, for the other, and is not truly other. We must do our duty to the other. We must abjure the material world. Should they kill us, bear it proudly, for it proves our virtue. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. The world isn't real. Only what I'm telling you is real. All will be brothers. Hallelujah. Hallelujah, brothers. All brothers. Most of the U.S. population died long blood poison with the Yudisha tupus. Whole cities, including New York, Los Angeles, Nashville, were wiped out as if by a single blow. Funeral pyres darkened such necropolises for months. This depopulation reduced the U.S. to an anarchic wasteland. Roving gangs of the young survivors of the Justice Crusade, who had also been victims of great ape integration in school, had their chance now. There was no Jew Institute, committee, judge, mayor, or complainer stopping them, so they formed a human liberation army and tore to chunks every ape or they saw or scented, every bonobo, chimpanzee, gorilla, orangutan. The tormented got their vengeance at last, in gouts of blood and spasms of primate screaming. Among the gangs there was talk of bunkers, but maybe the stories about them were only legends. The legends spoke of hidden enclaves in California and Washington State, forested fortresses, techno caves. Had the rich secured themselves? No one knew. Scene break. How's your arm? I'm all right, Mr. Bingham. Chad didn't mean Jake's broken arm. That healed months ago. He meant the knock Jake got from loading a motorcycle in the bed of a pickup truck. They had settled in Ulaanbaatar, the capital of Mongolia. Their journey there took many routes and several changes of identity, but they made it. And they ended by using their real names, Jack McAllister and Chad Bingham. Jake was teaching biology at a private university. His salary paid for a studio apartment not far from the city's central park. Farther out, Chad had an older place and repaired motorcycles at a mechanic shop. Jake helped Chad now and then, loading or unloading motorcycles and assisting with some repairs. Liberation didn't have much to do in Mongolia. The percentage of Jews here had always been comparatively small. Ulaanbaatar simply did without roughly 5% of its total population of 2 million. Private universities here didn't have the most restrictive hiring requirements. Jake hadn't needed a teaching certificate to get his job. The school staff, as well as his 40 students, rated his biological knowledge highly. That he spoke native English was a significant plus. As for Chad, he got his job by chance. He repaired an official's broken-down motorcycle roadside and struck up a conversation with him. The official spoke English. Soon Chad had contacts and worked with them until he succeeded. Unlike in the former U.S. and the whole Western world, so controlled by Jews, here a good man could get work and build a life. The reason they went all the way to Mongolia struck them as obvious once they'd reached the capital. They wanted to get as far away from Israel and the Western world as humanly possible. They kept going obsessively until they couldn't go any further. They settled where they had to stop. At first it was Chad who had helped Jake, who had the tougher time of it. Jake believed that he should have died in Israel and didn't want to build a life for himself. He forfeited his life, so why was he still alive? He didn't feel guilty, it just didn't seem logical that he had escaped all the consequences. Jake told Chad what he had done. Chad had no problem with it. He told Jake many stories about Israelis and how they instigated the Iran war. He loathed them. That Jake had disposed of the real enemy seemed to Chad as laudable as taking out the trash. Exterminating Jews is the same as taking out the trash. Quite true. Jake had a hard time accepting Chad's callous take, but it's millions of people, millions. Millions can die in war. So what you're saying is kill or be killed. Yes. Chad pointed to his prosthetic arm. You think I have any sympathy? You think the world has any sympathy for them after all the wars they started? Jake could only shake his head, but after all, in truth, that was his own view, too. At first, Jake went through the motions of his new job. He was professional about it. He neglected nothing, but his heart wasn't in it. The odd intelligence of a couple students caught his attention, and he began to teach them, particularly. Almost every day they made progress. They reminded him of himself at their age, quick, serious, leaping ahead of the book, and the professor leaping into the adulthood of doing science. They had work areas that engaged him, though owing to their age, those areas tended to change every few weeks. Jake wondered what to say to them about that. He wondered what he would have said about it to his younger self. As for the other students, the job didn't demand a great deal, just the exercise of new skills. He never thought of himself as a pedagogue before, maybe as a senior advisor to peers. Explaining meiosis to teenagers was new. At last, he settled into the job, thinking of his students and nothing else, and nothing in the wider world. Now, having finished the motorcycle on the pickup truck, Jake and Chad left Moto Rider's garage and went for a beer at the Dublin Pub nearby. The Dublin Pub, only one of many Irish-themed bars in Ulaanbaatar, issued a dark breath when they opened the door and walked inside. They found their usual spot at the bar and sat down on the old bar stools while a tough-faced but friendly female bartender took their order. Chad had one beer, and Jake had two, plus a bowl of buzz, or meat dumplings, as a snack. B-U-U-Z. I don't know if that's a real thing there or not. Pardon me. Buzz. Or meat dumplings. B-U-U-Z. Kraflach. They watched the television in silence for a while. It told what they already knew from many other sources, such as newspapers and word of mouth among other expats, old and young. The healing had started. The healing of the world, the natural reordering of human society. The Aryan Tikkun Olam stood out, so even the broadcasters who remained in existence noticed it and commented on it. After a fight for power, groups everywhere were establishing commerce and order. In Russia again, in broken China, in the global south. Much of Europe remained in disarray. Warlords there battled each other still, though rarely heard from. Not everything about the U.S. was dark. The small towns with semi-unpolluted rivers, semi-intact railroad tracks, and semi-viable farmland nearby had simply returned to business as well as they could manage. For government, they reverted to their old town charters, discreetly purged of anti-human elements such as GAI and anti-commerce strictures like high taxes. After all, great apes numbered fewer all the time since they were unsupported and even hunted, and there wasn't much to tax anyway. The towns established relations with each other, picking up almost where they left off, restoring a template of civilization. It amazed Jake how fast order established itself, how rapidly constructive human action emerged and advanced when simply left alone. Yep, that's what would happen. There was a ways to go, and nothing would be the same again. Not exactly the same, but close enough to avoid a planetary dark ages for certain. Jake reflected on the reasons why the world healed so fast after the Jews died. How could people establish trust that fast? The answer seemed to him that words increasingly meant what they said instead of the opposite of what they said. So the Jewish inversion of language, along with everything else, was reversed. Global gaslighting was subsiding to a long-forgotten minimum. The enemy of all mankind, the species of the lie, the people of the lie, the great masters of the lie, as Schopenhauer called them, was gone. The world was no longer full of lies because it was no longer full of Jews. The world was no longer full of lies because the world was no longer full of Jews. Did he feel proud of eradicating them? In truth, he felt no exhilaration when thinking about it. Only a kind of exhaustion. And he still felt that he hadn't paid for it somehow. I tried calling Dale's number again last night, Chad said. And? Jake asked. No luck. Jake was silent. They say things are getting better in America, Chad went on. I hear of underground compounds where rich people duck the bad shit. Could be, Jake said. Chad looked at him. I'm leaving to find her. I understand, Jake said after a moment. When? Tomorrow morning, Chad answered after finishing his beer. Do you have enough Chad, cut him. I have enough. I have money. How will you get back? Transportation. I booked a flight to St. Petersburg. Then it's a matter of flying Aero Rus over the pole to Anchorage. I'll get there, then to San Jose. Well, good luck. Thank you. They didn't have to say anything more. Jake paid and they left the pub. In the street, where the typically icy wind of the city started blowing up, Chad turned to Jake. Jake said, "You're the most courageous man I know." "Back at you, TL," Chad said. He raised his hand in farewell and left. Jake watched him walk away down the sidewalk. The Bogd Khan mountain framed Chad's swaggering, vanishing silhouette, as well as the end of the street. The mountain was pink, purple, black, white, gray. The shifting late afternoon light was melting into the early evening, darkening the mountain. The street remained bright, now lit by streetlights. Jake noticed some garbage men. The garbage men were unblocking part of the street by removing some garbage. Jake thought that he should have died in Israel, but Chad had told him differently. He said killing the Jews had no deeper meaning than garbage removal. Maybe Chad was right. He knew he was right. And what else did Chad say? "Back at you." Was he the most courageous man Chad knew? It struck him that this was his virtue. His virtue was courage. And courage, what was that? It was the expression of honesty, the keystone of the noble values. Honesty, the keystone of the noble values. After a long quest for nobility, he didn't reach it. Instead, he found he always had it. The quest had troubled him, but with this discovery, it ended. And that would be the end of the Eradicator. The Eradicator. The Jews are eradicated by a scientist who has the ability to figure out how to do it. And we know for a fact, admitted by former Mossadist, Victor Ostrovsky, the Jews themselves were working on ethnic and racial lab poisons decades ago. So, very nice conclusion to a very good book, Mike Smith's The Eradicator, novel, 2024. Mike Smith has a Substack you can look up, and this reading and the little commentary will be available permanently archived at vnnforum.com. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again with new material real soon.